From WAMC in Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly magazine about New York State government and politics. Your host is David Gastina, with political commentary by Dr. Alan Shartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
Coming up this week, Governor Cuomo makes changes to prevent any future bid rigging in his upstate economic development programs. Our political observer Alan Shartok shares his thoughts on whether legislators deserve a pay raise, and a New York congressman wants the president to intervene in a pipeline project. Those stories and more on the Legislative Gazette. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo is making some changes to prevent any future bid rigging in some of his major economic development projects. But critics on both the left and the right say the governor is failing to address the bigger picture, whether the $8.6 billion worth of programs are an effective use of public monies. More now from the Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt.
The secretive nature of awarding contracts for major projects like the Buffalo Billion led to an alleged bid rigging scheme by some of Governor Cuomo's associates. At least that's what U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara is charging in a criminal complaint. Critics say the use of a unique private not-for-profit company to arrange the bids was a formula for potential corruption. The criminal complaint alleges that SUNY Polytechnic used the Fort Schuyler and other management companies to steer tens of thousands of dollars to contractors who were key Cuomo campaign contributors. In addition, the complaint says, the former head of SUNY Poly, Elaine Calieros, and longtime Cuomo associate and lobbyist Todd Howe personally profited through bribes and kickbacks. E.J. McMahon, with the fiscal watchdog group the Empire Center, says Governor Cuomo actively sought to limit oversight of the contract awards process. In 2011, along with the legislature, he approved a law to bar the state controller from auditing any contract signed by SUNY, CUNY, and their affiliates.
He's done everything he can to kind of remove oversight from the executive branch, and unfortunately the legislature has generally accommodated him. But they've been completely AWOL on this whole thing.
While McMahon's group is fiscally conservative, Richard Brodsky is a liberal Democrat and former assemblyman. He headed a key oversight committee. It was set up to police public authorities and other entities related to the powers of the governor. Brodsky agrees that the private not-for-profits like Fort Schuyler were the perfect setup to create opportunities for corruption.
Some very shrewd lawyers found a loophole.
Brodsky says when he was chair of the oversight committee, he sponsored a law to close a previous loophole that also led to secret economic development contracts and potential corruption. At one point, under Governor George Pataki, a contributor to the governor made a deal to buy key portions of the Erie Canal for just $30,000. That deal was later scrapped. Brodsky says once the loophole allowing local development corporations to negotiate contracts was eliminated, new ways were created, like using the private not-for-profits to award contracts.
That loophole has to be closed. We closed similar loopholes for public authorities. They found a new one and exploited it.
Governor Cuomo seems to have realized belatedly that the use of the private not-for-profits to oversee public contracts is flawed. He announced a day after the criminal charges were filed against his associates that he's yanking all contract authority for economic development projects from SUNY Poly and giving it to his own economic development agency.
We're now transferring the responsibility to the Empire State Development Corporation. ESD will design its own procurement system.
Cuomo also deflected blame for any corruption, saying it was SUNY who was ultimately responsible for the contract process and that until recently he hadn't heard any criticisms, although several newspapers had detailed potential conflicts of interest and questionable timelines of campaign contributions to the governor and the awarding of key contracts. Several reform groups also asked questions over a year ago.
It was in place. It was working well. And there had been no complaints about the process.
Cuomo admits that he now knows the process was deficient. Former Assemblyman Brodsky says it's not enough, though, to simply shift the contract authority elsewhere. He says the loophole needs to be closed.
Institutional reform is not transferring power from one remote semi-private corporation to another. It needs law.
He says otherwise there's nothing to prevent bad behavior from happening again in a few months after everyone has moved on to other issues. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. Alan, this week, Governor Andrew Cuomo in Skinny Atlas, New York, said once again he knew nothing of the alleged corruption and the charges that have involved his close aides, Todd Howe, Joe Prococo, as well as the head of SUNY Poly, suspended now, Elaine Calleros. And for Cuomo, it's disappointed. It was emotional. And, of course, we have the specter of the U.S. attorney, Preet Bharara, once again involved in the prosecution.
David, the circle grows tighter. Look, let's face it. This is terrible for Cuomo. The issue, of course, is he's got a third-term election coming up in a couple of years. New Yorkers have very short memories. But third terms for governors, including his father, are very, very tough. And elections, because people have just basically had enough. Mario Cuomo, who I knew quite well, was done in by running for a fourth term. So he has this big problem, and now it turns out that the people who he has been extolling as his best friends, his brother, his top operatives, they were all allegedly, and I say allegedly, crooks. And as a result of that, what is he going to say? He's responsible for his administration. Hey, look, he picked these guys. He stayed with them all of this time. They bailed out when they were told to bail out, I suspect, although one never knows. And the result is that some of this stuff attaches to the governor. You can't get away from it. Let's assume he knew nothing, which strains some people's credibility. But you better believe that he's responsible for who's in his administration. The same way I am, for example, and who serves at WAMC. Something goes wrong, the person at the top who's done the picking gets the heat.
From heat to pay raises, Alan, we were talking last week about how the governor's aides had floated the idea that lawmakers might get their pay raise if it was tied to greater ethics reform. Now it's looking less likely they'll get their raise as a commission designed to take politics out of the issue is now coming under political pressure not to grant the salary increase.
What a bunch of baloney. I mean, this is really something. Cuomo, as we have just discussed, is under intense pressure, particularly on the matter of ethics. He needs a home run. He needs a Hail Mary pass. And this is it. Okay, guys, I'll give you the money for a raise because I know that's what you want more than anything else. If you pass an ethics package which will redound to who you are and your identity. And I don't think they're going to do it. He's come up with several ethics packages in the past, including one this year, and they all stink. They're lukewarm, they don't work, they don't mean much. So now, faced with all of this, he is trying his best to get something through so he gets credit for it. And believe me, he really needs it.
How about this idea from the publication City and State? Tom Allen writes, born to run, is Preet Bharara destined for political office?
Well, we're going to be hearing more and more of that. First of all, we have the disgrace of Hillary Clinton saying that she didn't know whether Preet Bharara would be renominated if she becomes president. Will you please, please explain to me how that is smart if you're running in a presidential campaign and this is one of the most admired men around and is doing this work and then backed up by the man who has the most to do with Bharara, and that's Chuck Schumer, who said, yes, it's too early. Well, I don't get that. I've never gotten it from the day that these two said it. Bharara, of course, is an appointed person. And if they don't appoint him, I would say, run, Preet, run.
Finally, there's a trial going on in neighboring New Jersey, which is somewhat connected to New York through the Port Authority, and that's Bridgegate. And we're hearing testimony from Chris Christie's top aide that, well, Christie knew.
Well, again, I used the term before, strains credibility. We do know that Christie knew real time as it was happening. That's what the testimony has shown us. Did he know before? Did he have anything to do with it? We are told no. Governors tend to shield themselves, and the people around governors tend to shield themselves. And that's what's happening here. He is being protected. Now, there's a real similarity between what's going on with Christie in New Jersey and Cuomo in New York. His top aides were in on it. Do you say to Christie, okay, you have to fire them, you have to get rid of them, you have to make them quit, you have to make them walk the plank? But frankly, Governor, you're the one who hired them all. Well, let me put it this way. He may not face criminal charges, but the one thing that has happened is it has so strained his credibility that because he is not allowed to run for office another time under the New Jersey laws and constitution, he is in he's in a pickle unless Donald Trump wins, because he's really hitched his wagon to Donald Trump. If Trump wins, there'll probably be a cabinet post in it for him. That is, if we don't learn more from this trial.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Giustina. The North Country Chamber of Commerce and two county legislators hosted a visit by the New York State Assembly Majority Leader this week. Democrat Joe Morelli was briefed on regional economic development strategies and projects and then toured the region's transportation manufacturing facilities. The Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley was there and filed this report.
The Plattsburgh North Country Chamber of Commerce periodically brings in individuals who could impact policies and legislation to strengthen their understanding of the regional economy. On Tuesday, officials hosted the New York Assembly Majority Leader on a tour of the region's transportation manufacturing sector. Joe Morelli saw subway cars being made at Bombardier Transportation, stopped by the Nova Bus Prevost Bus Manufacturing Plant, and ended the day with a walkthrough of construction at the Plattsburgh International Airport's expansion. Plattsburgh North Country Chamber of Commerce President and CEO Gary Douglas reports that discussion topics included the region's Canadian connection and why the MTA matters to the North Country.
We had the pleasure of providing him with a bit of background about our Canadian connection here in the North Country and how uniquely we're making that work for us. We then showed him a couple of examples of that going to both Bombardier and the Nova Bus Prevost car operation, which also links into the work that he and his colleagues have done on transportation funding, including the passage in December of a five-year capital plan for the MTA. Very important to have Joe see firsthand where some of those dollars go and how New York is producing some of the end product that is made possible for the MTA and others here in New York.
8,100 people are employed in 32 companies in the transportation manufacturing sector in northern New York. Morelli is impressed with the North Country's success in that sector.
The focus on transportation and the kind of people I had a chance to meet is really extraordinary. And one of the things that I've really appreciated about the Regional Economic Development Council process has been each region forced to focus on those transformative industries. And clearly transportation, the transportation hub here, is second to none in the state of New York.
Morelli is a member of the Finger Lakes Regional Economic Development Council, where he says development focuses on optics, photonics, food processing and agriculture, and next-generation manufacturing. He believes the REDCs have forced regions to focus on sectors that will grow their economy.
There are common themes. It's no secret that if you're from upstate New York, the region that I represent, we are going through a transformation. Manufacturing will continue to be very, very important to us. But it's a changing manufacturing workplace. And so we have to make sure that we continue to change and adjust our thinking to be competitive.
Local Republican Assemblywoman Janet Dupree says Morelli now has the knowledge to strongly advocate for North Country issues.
Now he can speak with absolute authority about what we're doing here, and he gets the part about how taxes and some of the fees and some of the regulations on our small businesses are just not good. And I think it's critical that the majority leader remains upstate because of the 65 Democrats from the city. And I'm not knocking them as city Democrats, but they have a different view so often of and don't understand what our issues are upstate. And Joe Morelli sure gets it.
The Assembly Majority Leader's visit was co-hosted by the Clinton and Franklin County legislatures.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
A New York congressman has written to President Obama, asking him to intervene in a pipeline project under construction in the Hudson Valley. Meanwhile, a coalition of groups has asked a federal court to stop the pipeline's construction. The Legislative Gazette's Allison Dunn explains.
Democratic Congressman Elliot Engel penned a letter to President Obama to bring his attention to concern over Spectra Energy's Algonquin Incremental Market, or AIM, project. Construction has been underway for more than a year.
Frankly, a lot of the groups that have really been involved with this have been very frustrated in that they've been thwarted at every turn and suggested to me that could we contact the president? And I said, sure. So, you know, again, we're not quite sure what he can do with this, but I wanted to bring it to his attention because it's important. You know, it involves national security. It involves public safety. It certainly involves my constituents. So we'll see what happens. I mean, my attitude is that I don't want to leave any stone unturned. I want to keep fighting this.
Much of Houston-based Spectra's AIM pipeline is replacing 26-diameter pipeline with 42-inch diameter pipeline. The project starts in Rockland County and moves through Westchester and Putnam counties before heading into Connecticut, Rhode Island, and Massachusetts. Again, Engel.
You know, right now we are trying to figure out anyway. Maybe some people would say grasping at straws, but I think we're trying to figure out what's best. And I'm sure the president can be helpful if the administration chooses to be.
Part of the expansion includes a portion of the property of the Buchanan-based Indian Point nuclear power plant, where there already are two lines. Engel expresses his concern about the pipeline's proximity to Indian Point in his letter to the president. Indian Point takes no position on the pipeline, and officials there worked with Spectra to enhance protective measures, such as increasing the pipe's thickness and burying the pipe deeper. Indian Point Parent Energy had commissioned an independent analysis of impacts that could result from pipeline failure, and the analysis determined there were no increased risks. In addition, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission conducted an analysis and reached the same conclusion. Engel, Riverkeeper, and others argue that the analysis was not independent. And Engel, who serves on the House Energy and Commerce Committee, believes the lack of an independent risk assessment stems from the following.
And what really, you know, has irritated me for a long, you know, for many years now that I've been in Congress, and I'm on the Energy and Commerce Committee, it's that, you know, the coziness between the industry and the regulatory people.
A FERC spokesperson did not respond in time for this broadcast. Meanwhile, environmental group Riverkeeper, as part of a coalition, has filed a motion for a stay, asking a federal court to order the pipeline construction to be halted. John Parker is director of legal programs for Westchester County-based Riverkeeper.
And here's a simple request. Don't let the gas go through the pipeline. It's not too late to avert a problem if we're smart. If we stop the gas going through the pipeline, no matter where it is in terms of the construction, we can have an analysis on the right way and then determine whether or not the pipeline has to be moved. After the gas is turned on and the gas moves through the pipeline, unfortunately, it could be too late.
A lawsuit challenging FERC's approval of the project is currently pending in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. A Spectra spokeswoman in an emailed statement says, quote, Algonquin Gas Transmission will continue with its construction of the Algonquin Incremental Market, or AIM, project in accordance with the FERC certificate to meet the project's critical construction timeframes and safely transport additional supplies of clean, reliable domestic natural gas to heat the region's homes and businesses, end quote. As for the motion of stay, neither Spectra nor FERC comments on ongoing litigation. Parker says the motion for a stay also is based on new information from experts about safety risks of placing the pipeline near a nuclear power plant, information that was not part of the original record.
not on the record originally, critical with respect to the blast zone and impact areas if a rupture was to occur, and has to be addressed on the merits before gas flows to that pipeline.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Allison Dunn.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. There's a growing list of politicians now urging the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to require General Electric to conduct additional dredging on the Hudson River. More now from the Legislative Gazette's Lucas Willard.
U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand sent a letter to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency saying General Electric's dredging of the upper Hudson River is not complete. In her letter, the senator, who serves on the Environment and Public Works Committee, told EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy that, quote, PCB hotspots continue to remain in the Hudson River. The remaining contamination will result in continued injury to natural resources and slow the economic and ecological recovery of the river, unquote. Gillibrand wrote, there's a need to dredge the Champlain Navigational Canal, though the original PCB cleanup agreement between GE and EPA did not include the Champlain Canal. On Friday, New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman wrote to EPA, urging the agency to remain on the river until further testing is completed to ensure PCB contaminants are being removed effectively. The two prominent politicians' letters fall in line with recent actions from New York State DEC Commissioner Basil Segos and Congressman Sean Patrick Maloney, who also called for additional cleanup. The politicians echo sentiments by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration, both federal trustees for the Hudson River Superfund site. Environmental groups like Riverkeeper and Scenic Hudson are praising the increased pressure for additional PCB removal. GE wrapped up its dredging work last fall, and a dewatering facility has been shut down. Scenic Hudson's Ned Sullivan criticized EPA for allowing the dismantling.
GE should not have removed its cleanup equipment, that EPA should not have allowed the decommissioning, because more work is needed. EPA acted prematurely because it is currently conducting a five-year review required by federal law that under which the agency is determining whether the cleanup goals have been met.
In an email, spokeswoman Larissa Romanowski said EPA is reviewing the letters and will consider them as it conducts its five-year review. Of Gillibrand's recent letter, she writes, quote, EPA shares the senator's commitment to cleaning up the Hudson River and will respond directly to the senator's letter, unquote. She continues, quote, the EPA can't do navigational dredging under the Superfund program, but the state of New York has the opportunity to get navigational dredging if they pursue dredging the Champlain Canal, unquote. GE will remain on the river for continued monitoring and maintains it has fulfilled its commitment as mandated by EPA. Spokesman Mark Behan.
And since dredging was completed, PCB levels in the upper Hudson have already shown significant declines. EPA has declared the project a success and said no additional dredging is necessary.
Addressing concerns from state leaders, Behan said the state approved, oversaw, and was involved in every major decision about the cleanup project.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Lucas Willard.
And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1640. Or just listen or podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.
Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare online at nysut.org.